Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In this discussion, we will be talking with Miss Laura Thoma. She's a student at the university somewhere in Poland, which I still am not able to pronounce. We will be talking about the social impacts of biometric technology and what that has upon the countries of the world. As we know, many of the countries around the world, like in Europe, Africa, and the APAC region, they're very quick to adopt biometrics, but here in the U.S., we're still laggards. So, Laura, why don't you just go ahead and just introduce yourself to our audience out here, like what you do, what's your specialization in, on your thesis is, and more importantly, what university do you study at? That'd be, if I can pronounce that correctly, that'd be great. So please, just take a few minutes to introduce yourself to our audience.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me, Ravi. I'm very excited to do this with you. So I'm from Switzerland and currently enrolled in the European Master Program in Human Rights and Democratization. And at the moment, I'm based in Poland. And I'm focusing in my master's thesis on the impact of biometrical systems at the outside borders of Europe. And I really want to know how the application of biometrical systems impact women's rights. And I try to focus on forced migration a little bit. So I really want to figure out how the systems work, how the algorithm behind the biometrical systems work, but also how the data is stored, what is going to happen with the personal data, and what cybersecurity measures could be applied to make this information more secure, since it's very sensitive information collected at the borders.
Okay.
Yeah,
I
that's
know
about it.
Go ahead.
No, I'm finished. I think the rest will come up later.
Okay. I know you have a series of questions you'd like to ask me, so do you want to get started with those questions first, or would you like to have just an overall introduction to how biometric technology works?
I think it would be helpful to start with an overall introduction.
Okay. Well, basically what biometrics is just basically taking a physical representation or a behavioral representation of our individual selves. So basically, in the world of physics, there are two worlds of biometrics. There is the physical world and the behavioral world. In terms of the physical world, there are certain physiological traits that are unique to each and every human being. They're like your face, your fingerprint, your iris, your retina, your voice. Those are the primary physical unique characteristics that we have in each of all of us. In terms of behavioral biometrics, that just measures our unique behavioral patterns. And the two most widely used ways of keeping track of this are like the way you type on a computer keyboard. Okay, there's a unique rhythmic pattern on the way that we type our keys. So, for example, I may type W first and then R second or whatever the word is. There's a unique rhythm in that. And there's a unique pressure, speed, and stroke pattern in which we type our content on a keyboard. With signature recognition, that's not how our signature exactly looks. Okay, there's a lot of confusion. Signature recognition is not comparing our signature and how close that looks to, like, another person. So, example, my signature is the worst in the world, so people often confuse, okay, how does my signature look with the signature of Laura Thoma, right? But that's not what it is. Signature recognition is basically, it's keeping track of the behavioral mannerisms in which we sign our name. So it'll be like the pressure that we apply on the pen, how fast we sign, whether we hold the pen at an angle or like 45-degree angle or a 90-degree angle. The system, the signature recognition system tries to capture those unique patterns. So as you can see, as I've described with the behavioral biometrics, the physical biometrics captures our unique physiological characteristics much the same way. So like with fingerprint recognition, it's claimed that each daring human being has a unique fingerprint, which is true. Now, it's not the visible fingerprints that we are interested after. It's rather, if you take your fingerprint and look at it under a microscope, there are very unique, you know, worlds, valleys, and ridges. That's what's unique to each and every person on this earth, and that's what makes fingerprint recognition so robust. In terms of facial recognition, you know, we're looking at capturing the various, you know, distances between the objects in our face. Like, for example, the distances between the eyebrows and the eyes, the nose to the chin to the lips. So we're looking at all these kinds of, you know, different distances. And each and every human being, in fact, Laura, even you and I, we have a different, you know, centimeter distance or inch distance between our eyes, our nose. You know, everybody has that unique feature. And in terms of the eye recognition, that's probably the one that I'm the most passionate about. That's the one that's of most interest to me. With the eye, there are two parts of it that can be scanned. One is the iris, and that is simply the colored region that's in front of the eye. Okay, like you have your pupil and then you have the sclera, the white of the eyes. That colored banded region is known as the iris. And that constricts accordingly, and that allows how much light will enter in the pupil so that we can see things properly, so that data information that we get from the external world into our pupil but can then be transmitted to our brain to, you know, to convert that into the images that we see, like an almost, you know, second-by-second basis. Now, with retinal recognition, there is a mapping of the blood vessels in the back of the eye, and that's known as the retina. If you just simply even Google retinal scans, I think even on my website, there might be a picture of a retina. Or even Laura, the book that I shared with you, the very first book, there should be an image of a retinal image. Basically, all these blood vessels in the back of the eye, they congregate in one area, and that's called the optic disc. Now, the optic disc then has a nerve connected to it called the optic nerve, and then the optic nerve then connects directly to the brain, and that's what actually transmits the information data from the eye to the brain, the raw information data, I might add to that, in order to convert that into the decipherable images that we can see every day that we take for granted so much. Now, when it comes to the eye, the iris and the retina are the most unique to everybody on this planet. I mean, they have the most unique features and data sets. And in terms of the iris, scientific studies have even shown that even identical twins have, you know, unique iris structures. I think there was some study back in the 1930s or some early 1940s where some ophthalmologist did some kind of research study. He found that identical twins have a different iris structure, which is just fascinating. In fact, iris recognition really got its fame. Remember from that National Geographic picture, the Afghan girl, you know, Sherbet Gula? I think back in the 1980s when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, there were a lot of refugees. And there's one image of an Afghan refugee girl called Sherbet Gula. Her eyes were so striking. And a photographer from the National Geographic magazine, he actually took her picture. And that became world famous. In fact, then 20 years later, the same photographer with an iris recognition team from an iris recognition company at the time, I think they were called, I don't remember what the name of the company was, but they were able to track her down and locate her again 20 years later, all because of iris recognition. And in the book that I shared with you, Laura, that first book, I think I wrote a case study on that too, so that'll have all the information there too. And there might be some stuff on my website. It's called The Afghan Girl, Sherbet Gula. In fact, if you want, after our conversation, you can Google Sherbet Gula, Sherbatgula. And you'll see everything. It's really, really striking. And then I think the other physical modality that I'm not missing is the voice. Now, everyone has a unique inflection in which they talk, you know, there's a different pitch, rate, inflection, and that's what's also captured in by the voice recognition system. Now, there are some other emerging biometric technologies that I should talk about. One is vein pattern recognition, and that's basically looking at the pattern, the unique pattern of veins in your fingertip or on your palm. There's another one called palm print recognition, which is hardly even spoken of today in the biometric industry, and that just measures the unique, you know, structure of your palm. So, oh, speaking of which, there is another biometric modality too, which I almost forgot about, and that's hand geometry recognition. And that's probably the oldest of the biometric technologies. That thing came out, I think, in the 1950s or 1960s. And basically what that does, that tries to measure the unique structure of your hand. So if you put your finger in a hand reader, the camera is going to take like 96 measurements of your hand, like the distances between your fingers, the distances between your nails and your knuckles, and the shape of your overall hand. That's what hand geometry recognition is. It's been around like the longest time, and it's still widely used just because it's been around like for decades. There are other biometric technologies that are being under research and development that I don't know if they will come out into fruition or not, if they will prove you viable biometric technologies or not. One of them is gait recognition. That's the way we walk. You know, each of us have a unique stride in the way we walk. So, for example, Laura, you'll have a unique way in which you walk, okay? I have a unique way I walk, my walking stride, my walking style. Everybody has that. That has had some promise. Now, whether that turns out to be a viable biometric technology, I don't know. Another one is DNA recognition. I'm recognizing an individual based upon their unique DNA strands. If that ever turns into a reality, that'll be the most unique biometric of all. That'll be like the mother of all biometrics, because that has the richest information about anybody, because that's after all, our DNA. And what DNA recognition does, it just compares and examines the four strands of the DNA strands that we have. I think it's cytosine, adenine, guanine, and thymine. And those are the four strains that this potential modality could actually try to come cross-compare. But let me tell you, if this thing does become into a reality, it will be the most controversial biometric technology of all, because this will really raise a ruckus around the world. There will be a lot of privacy rights issues, not just here in the United States, but all over the world, especially in Europe, I'm sure. You know, like in Germany, Switzerland, Poland, you know, in the EC countries in Western Europe. Because there'll be cries of civil liberty violations, privacy rights, you know, Big Brother watching, what's the government doing with my DNA? But that's a whole different issue of biometrics that we can explore later on into a different podcast. And then the other one is, let's see, we talked about DNA. Then the other one is earlobe recognition. Now, studies have shown that each of us actually have a different earlobe structure. Now, I'm not talking about the inside of the ear, but how the ear looks on the outside, like in a manner very much of fingerprint recognition or like hand geometry recognition. So, Laura, for example, you might have a different earlobe structure or earlobe appearance than what I do. And that's what the research is trying to prove, that all of us have this different structure. And that's just another way of, you know, identifying our individual selves, or, you know, verifying our identity. So those are the main biometric modalities that are out today, you know, fingerprint recognition, eye recognition, voice recognition, facial recognition, hand geometry. Those are the most widely used today. In terms of behavioral, it's signature, keystroke, and I just talked about the ones that are still being under research and development. Now, there could very well could be others that I have not come across yet, but if you do another Google search, I'm sure that there will probably be some others that are being researched right now. They could be different variants of what I just talked about. But the most widely used and the most widely accepted biometric technologies, I think, worldwide are fingerprint recognition, hand geometry recognition, facial recognition, and the iris recognition. Those are the most four widely used ones. You're not going to see voice being used as much, neither keystroke nor signatures, because they just have not made their entrance into the marketplace. So that's those are the main different modalities right now. So how biometrics works, and I get this question asked quite a bit because here in the United States, Laura, I've got to be honest with you, we live in a very reactive society, okay? People are very reluctant to use biometrics. Now, in Europe, people are a lot more open using biometrics, okay? Because here in the United States, talking more about the social implications, which we'll get into later in the show, we have this thing called the Constitution of the United States of America, okay? Now, we are afforded certain rights and liberties in which we'll be counted by as individual beings in the eyes of our own government. And if we're not, we're offered a legal recourse. That's why here in America we are so reluctant to use biometric technology because we claim it's a violation of our privacy rights, constitutional rights, blah, blah, blah. I mean, to me, it's just a bunch of nonsense, but that's just how we are as a society. Now, in Europe, I'm not exactly sure what kind of, you know, constitutions or bylaws you have there, but I would think that in Europe there's not as much ruckus for privacy rights or, you know, civil liberties right violations as there are in the U.S. Because from what I've read about, I think Europeans are much more accepting of it than us Americans here. And in fact, you'll see in, like, African nations, you know, in Africa and in the Middle East, like Afghanistan especially, they're so welcoming of biometric technologies. For them, it's like, you know, having a, you know, giving them drinking water, because now at last they're able to be counted as individuals in the eyes of their own government because there's a unique electronic ID that's associated with them, right? So now they can be counted as these unique individuals, and now they can get the benefits and the welfare and whatever things that they're entitled to, you know, like Social Security, you know, what have you, by the government. So as you can see, I mean, I'm kind of rambling here, but biometric technology, not only is it a technology issue, but there's also a lot of social implications that go along with that. And you'll not see that with any other type of security technology. I mean, there's just so much of social implications that go with biometrics. I mean, it's crazy. And in that regard, here in the United States, it's facial recognition that's the most prone to privacy rights issues and, you know, cries of civil liberty rights and so forth and so forth. The fingerprint in the iris, not so much, but it's facial recognition that's really taking a big hit here in the U.S. So how biometric technology works, loosely put, each technology is going to be different. So I'll give the example of, like, fingerprint and iris. So if you Google biometrics, you'll very often see, like, an external device. Okay, Laurie, there will be, like, a little optical scanner, okay, that you put your fingerprint on. Have you, what kind of cell phone do you have? Do you have, like, an iPhone or Samsung or something like that? Or?
Yeah, I'm having an iPhone 6S, I
okay.
guess.
Does it have that touch ID where you put your fingerprint on, that optical sensor?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, that's
but
exactly
not yet
what
the facial.
Yeah, that's the face ID that comes, I think, the iPhone 10, which people have paid thousands of dollars for, which I think is crazy. But anyway, that's a different topic. But anyway, what you see on your iPhone, that's called touch ID, and that's exactly what biometrics is all about, but on a very, very primitive low level. So when you put that fingerprint onto the optical sensor, a series of raw images are taken by that sensor, okay? That is then combined into one image, which is called the composite image. That's the master raw image of your fingerprint, okay? Then once that master image has been compiled, the extraction algorithm, which is another mathematical algorithm, then tries to take out those unique features of your fingerprints, which are found in the whorls and valleys and the ridges of your fingerprint. Then once those unique features are extracted, it then gets converted into what's called a mathematical template, okay? So, for example, when you scan your fingerprint into that touch ID, and once that image is created and those unique features are extracted, it's converted into what's known as a binary mathematical file format, meaning it gets converted into a series of zeros and ones, because binary means, you know, two. Binary means in mathematics either a zero or a one. It's like kind of like electrical switch theory. It's either on or off, right? So zero, one could be on, or one could be off. So if you scan, so this thing, next time you scan your fingerprint, Laura, your fingerprint's actually going to be probably like a series of 20 zeros and ones. And that is what gets stored into the database of the biometric system on a permanent basis. That's called the enrollment template, because you've just enrolled your fingerprint into the Touch ID and into the database of your iPhone. Okay? Now, for example, once you've done that, and suppose after you go to the cafe, you know, you hung out with your friends for a while, you come back home and you want to check your social media stuff, right? I'm sure you've got some. I know you're on LinkedIn because we're connected. Suppose you want to check your LinkedIn profile on your iPhone. Well, to log back in your iPhone, you got to, you know, type in that 6-digit code that you have, and the second layer of security will be to register, to put your fingerprint again, right? Well, now that you're going to go through the same process again, but rather than called the enrollment process, it's going to be called the verification process. The same thing will happen. It's going to take a series of pictures. You're going to get a composite image taken. Unique features will be taken, but that's not called the enrollment template. That will now be called the verification template. Again, that will be a series of zeros and ones. And then the iPhone will then cross-compare the binary mathematical file format between the enrollment template and the verification template. If there's enough statistical correlation or closeness between the two, your iPhone will let you log in and check in your LinkedIn profile. Okay? That's how that works. And the verification template is never, ever stored. That's always discarded. It's only the enrollment template. Now, in biometrics, there are two things that can be looked at. One's called verification, and the other is called authentication. In verification, we are just trying to confirm the identity of Laura to Laura. So, Laura, you're simply asking the question, am I really Laura? Okay, so basically your iPhone is trying to answer, okay, Laura's trying to access his iPhone. Is she really Laura who's trying to gain access? And that's yes, because, you know, your fingerprints, there was enough closeness between the two templates. That's what's called verification. You're trying to confirm the identity of Laura. Laura says she's Laura. Well, let's confirm to make sure Laura is Laura. That's called a one-to-one mathematical relationship, okay? When you're just trying to confirm the identity of just one individual, against their one fingerprint or their one iris. Okay. Now the other one is called identification. That's called a one to n or one to many mathematical relationship, because now what you're saying is, suppose at Starbucks, at your university or your cafe, there are 10 individuals. Okay. And you are amongst that group of 10 individuals and you say, I am Laura. But, well, how is the biometric system going to know that you're Laura out of 10 different people who are claiming to be Laura, right? So there are 10 different people claiming to be Laura, but are you really Laura Tomei? That's the biometric system is looking for. And that's called identification. It's trying to identify you based out of a group of X number of people, okay? That's what it does. So there are two application scenarios, verification and identification. And in the world today, there's not too many, as far as I know, there are not too many identification scenarios, or they're mostly verification scenarios, because most of the biometrics that are used now are like on the iPhone, you know, tablets, wireless devices, smartphones. But, you know, anyone can use biometric, any organization, any entity can use biometric technology all the way from the most rudimentary level, like on your iPhone, all the way to the most complex level, like, you know, providing a means of security at a nuclear facility, you know, wherever, you know, suppose like here in the United States, there's like a Minuteman, a Minuteman nuclear missile site. Obviously, the people who are going to gain access to those nuclear missiles, they're going to have a lot of security to go through, and some of them are going to be going through multiple layers of biometrics. And that's an example of identification. So that's kind of what biometrics is, you know, in a very, very crude level. The first book that you should have access to, Laura, that'll explain everything in a lot more detail. Now, one thing that I should make note of is that each biometric modality has their own way of creating mathematical files, okay? It's not always going to be a binary mathematical file. That's only unique for fingerprints. When it comes to iris and retinal recognition, they use a very complex set of mathematics called Gabor wavelet mathematics. Okay. What they do is they map the iris onto a 3D Cartesian geometric plane, and they look at the various objects that are in the iris, very diverse, unique objects, and they look at the vector orientations as to how those objects are placed in comparison to one another. That's something that's even kind of above my head, and that's something that you may want to, if you have more interest, you may want to purchase a book on Gabor wavelets. But that was the biometric modality that was used to track down the Afghan girl 20 years later, confirm her identity. And this actually became very famous because in England at the University of Cambridge, there's just one scientist called Dr. John Dogman, and he was the inventor of iris recognition of these algorithms to make it the way they are today. And the company that he worked for, they held in the United States, they held all the patents and trademarks, so really nobody could copy what they did. But those patents, probably about 10 years ago, they've expired. So now you're going to see there's been a whole plethora, a whole mushroom of new iris vendors coming out. In fact, I'm a reseller for an iris vendor called Iritech, and I'm trying to sell their iris-based solutions also as a means to replace a password. So that's what that is. Facial recognition, it uses statistical profiling. They use hidden Markov models. Same thing with voice recognition. And I believe in the same with the signature and keystroke recognition. They use more statistics than mathematics in order to build those enrollment and verification templates. Now, one thing, Laura, I do want to ask you is when I get in this far and explain about biometrics, the one question that you may get asked that too, because you're writing a thesis on biometrics, is what happens if my template is hacked into? Okay, I don't know if you've been asked that, but that's the one thing I get asked all the time. And I tell people, big deal if your template gets hacked into. First of all, everybody has a unique template, right? It can't be lost, it can't be erased, it's permanent only to you. And secondly, it's just a mathematical form, a formula. What can you do with a mathematical formula, right? A representation. It's not the same thing as stealing your credit card number. Like if you stole a credit card number, obviously there's a lot of damage you can do with that. But with like a fingerprint, verification template that's just a series of, zeros and ones, what can you do with that? Nothing. And another question I get asked is, I mean, can biometric recognition systems be spoofed? I don't think they can be spoofed. I mean, I'm not saying it's not impossible because technology is prone to, many things. It's prone to failure. But a biometric system requires that you have a live scan, meaning that there has to be a live person with a live heartbeat actually presenting their fingerprint or their iris. So, for example, Laura, in order to register your iPhone, you have to be actually live with a heartbeat, with a pulse in your fingerprint, in order for the iPhone to pick up the image of your fingerprint. Because I get asked quite a bit, well, can I rip out an eyeball from a dead body, or can I cut someone's fingerprint off or something? And no, that's a very crude way of looking at it. No, you can't do that. So these are some of the questions I get asked. They're unique, they're amusing, but these are some of the questions that I get asked. So that's it in a nutshell. That's what biometrics is all about, Laura. At this point, do you have any questions that I can answer?
Yes, actually, I'm wondering if the retina verification is invasive because I've read that some people are not sure if it's invasive and what are the long terms. I don't know if there's any medical health impact on the eye.
Okay, two things I can tell you. One, I okay, it's people consider invasive not because they're cognizantly aware of what's happening. It's only human nature, if we have our eye scanned, to cover our eye or blink because we want to protect our eye. That's just our knee-jerk reaction, okay? So, for example, if I were to shine this little iris camera in front of your eye to take an image of your iris, your tendency is to block it, to cover your eye. Okay, that's what the brain is telling us to do to protect our eye. That's what people mean by invasive, okay? It's not invasive because we're cognitively aware because it's invasive. It's just because it's our subconscious, our brain, trying to protect our eye. You see that? So, for example, it's like looking at the sun. I mean, you're not going to look at the sun for maybe more than a second before you cover your eyes. It's just our self-defense mechanism. And no, another question I get asked quite a bit is, can I get sick from using a biometric system? And I have not heard of any major illnesses occurring. Now, obviously, if you're going to be using a fingerprint system or a hand, geometry system, in which there's going to be direct contact with the, with the hardware, which other people are going to be using, maybe you could get a cold or something, but that's going to be up to the company or your employer who's ever using it to keep that thing clean. But no, there have been no known, serious ailments or, injuries or weaknesses. I've not heard of any stories of any eye injuries or anything like that.
Okay. Another question is, at the moment, usually in Europe, at borders, they take fingerprints and facial recognition. I think they're starting right now with iris recognition. They want to implement it till 2020, I guess. So far, there have been mistakes, especially with refugees. I'm not sure if it happened in Switzerland or Germany, but the fingerprint was matched wrong with the database of a person, and this person was identified as another person. And since we have the Dublin system, so you only are allowed to apply for asylum in the first entry country in Europe, in the Schengen zone.
Okay.
He got deported, but it was a mistake. So he was in, that was quite a case. So my question is, you explained to me fingerprints and facial recognition is quite unique, but not as unique. And especially, I mean, the face can change with time, with operations. When we had traumatic experiences, the expressions can change. What combination of biometrics would be like the safest or like the best combination to identify someone correctly? Or is it only iris recognition, since you can take an iris picture of a 3-year-old child and then it will be the same till death?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm quite surprised. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just very curious about your opinion on that.
Okay.
Also,
well,
about
first
the case I explained to you.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised. I never heard that story about. I mean, I haven't really been keeping in touch a lot about the biometric news lately because I've been doing more cybersecurity stuff, but I have not heard about that case. I'm quite surprised that the fingerprint recognition didn't work in that regard. Now, keep in mind that, with fingerprint recognition, it's a direct contact technology with the optical sensor. Or at least as far as I know, that's how the technology has evolved. Now, there might be a case where it might be what they call a non-contactless technology, meaning it can just take an image of a fingerprint from a far distance. But all of the fingerprint recognitions that I've come across have been direct touch. Now, a fingerprint recognition system, there are a number of things that could go wrong with that. Now, the optical sensor could have been dirty. It may not have been able to collect the correct image. Or the individual's fingerprint could have been damaged. Okay. Now, if a fingerprint image is severely damaged, if it's got like cuts, bruises, and abrasions, then it won't be able to register his fingerprint. So it could have been the case that maybe his fingerprint, when it was just not able to be recognized. Then in that case, the board official should have taken, another fingerprint or something, which I don't know. I don't know enough about it. Yeah, but there are instances where fingerprint recognition system may not typically recognize a fingerprint just because it's just, it's either aged too much or there's just too much damage to it. But most of the fingerprint recognition systems of today, they've become sophisticated enough that they can actually take into account some level of, abrasions or bruises or cuts. So if you have that story, Laura, send me a link to that. I'd like to take a look at that because I'm not exactly sure. That's the first time I've heard that. And Now, in terms of facial recognition, yeah, that is something that's a, as I said, here in the United States, that's just a hot button topic. And I'll tell you about the origins of that. Remember when 9/11 happened, when the terrorists knocked down the World Trade Center back in 2001, I think, September 11th?
Yeah, apparently they had pictures of them already, but not connected with facial recognition system, something like that.
Yeah. Well, after that incident happened, biometrics became like the big buzzword. Everybody was all excited about biometrics, okay? Here in this country, we had, investors and venture capitalists trying to invest money in all these biometric companies like the dot-com craze back in the late 90s, okay? But unfortunately, it was facial recognition that got the most acclaim. But then when facial recognition didn't live up to all the hype made by the U.S. media, it failed, okay? And then facial recognition was decried as one of the world's worst biometric technologies and so forth. It doesn't work. But the reason why facial recognition is still not perfect yet, I mean, it's come a long way. I mean, for example, facial recognition can be used at long distance. Okay, it's used in a lot of airport settings. It can capture many people all at once. It can capture an image, images of passengers from, 50, 60, 100 feet away. There was a time when it can only capture one individual at a time. It would have to capture, the image of the face of the individual, at one, one at a time, at a very close range. But now it's come to the point where it can, like for example, probably like this, like the German, like the Frankfurt International Airport or the Swiss International Airport. You'll probably see facial recognition cameras being there used quite a bit because now the technology has evolved that it can capture hundreds of people, probably just a matter of a few minutes, and get a good database of their facial samplings. And so it's evolved to that, but still not perfect because, as you had alluded to, the system still cannot take into account any changes in the face, like weight loss, weight gain, or any face or the absence or presence of facial hair, or if you're wearing sunglasses or, or a hat. In fact, any changes in the lighting can also, further impact the facial recognition system. So, I mean, if you like take the image of a person in like during the daylight, and then maybe take the image of the same person again during evening hours, the facial recognition system still probably won't recognize that because of the changes of the lighting in the external environment. Now, for your third question, the answer would be, I think here in this country, I'm going to segue a little bit to cybersecurity. In this country, here in the cybersecurity industry, they are mandating, or one of the big buzzwords is what they call multi-factor authentication, or what they call two-factor authentication, where you're using more than just one layer of security to confirm your identity or to verify you. So the first one would be like your PIN number or your password, and the second layer that's being used now quite a bit is biometric technology. And again, the prime examples of that is your iPhone. I mean, you probably have to log in with the password, PIN number, and you log in with your fingerprint. Now, I think the iPhone 10 now has that Face ID where they do, face recognition. I think with this kind of, multi-factor authentication, if we're going to be using biometrics along with a non-biometric, like, okay, suppose you're using your fingerprints. I would say no, suppose you're using a password. Use a fingerprint as a biometric, or use your iris as a second layer of security. Or if you're using something else other than a fingerprint that's non-biometric, then if you're using like an RSA token, use that RSA token like for a virtual private network. Then either use, iris or face or fingerprint recognition. Or if you want to use a strict, two-factor authentication using just biometric strictly. First layer should be just fingerprint recognition, and then the second layer should then be iris recognition. So long story short, in these multi-factor authentication two-level approaches, I think either fingerprint or iris would be the best one. But really, honestly, I think iris recognition is your best bet to use for any multi-factor authentication method that's used, whether it's using two levels of biometrics or just one level with a non-biometric being used. Because again, it's iris recognition that is really the iris has the most the most stable, Laura. I mean, it's the most stable biometric along the retina. It hardly changes over the lifetime of an individual. It's in your head, so it's in the skull, so it's pretty well protected unless, you know, you get punched in the face or you get, or there's an object from the extraneous environment that accidentally gets thrown in there. You know, you're not really prone to any ailments or any sicknesses of the eye. It's very stable, and the structure hardly ever changes. And at the same time, it also presents the most unique sets of data, you know, for a biometric system to really confirm your identity to 100%. So one thing I want to add on there, a biometric system can never 100%. There's no such thing as 100% match in biometrics. And what that means is, the enrollment template, when you compare that to the verification template, there is no such thing as 100% match between the two. It can only be like 90%, 92%. That's why they look at the degree of closeness. And the degree of closeness that's going to be examined is set by the systems administrator. Okay? And with that regard, there are two metrics that are important. They're called the false acceptance rate and the false rejection rate. But we can talk about that at a later time if you want to know more about that.
So, do you think the border management will drop the fingerprint and use iris recognition because it's so unique, but also facial recognition because they can make it in long distance as well for security reasons?
Well, they may just very well drop the fingerprint thing just because it didn't work for that one unique individual, but I can't speak for them. But, you know, I think if it's working for everybody else, but not for him, then they should keep fingerprint recognition. In fact, there's another metric that's used to gauge the accuracy rate of a biometric in an entire population, an entire country, and it's, I think, called the ability to verify rate, or the ATV. But yeah, I mean, if just one person cannot be verified by fingerprint, there's no need to discard the whole system, and it's maybe that one unique individual. But now, if everybody's having issues, and either it's not the individual, then it's their system that's having issues. In that case, the vendor needs to be called upon and see what's going on. You know, then it's a vendor technology issue. If it's more than like maybe 23% of the population that's being rejected, then there's something, either the threshold is set too high or too low, or there's something wrong with the software or the hardware, you know, supplied by the vendor. But I think fingerprint recognition is still viable. I would not really implore facial recognition too much because I still think it has issues, but I think iris recognition will be the one that's going to be used quite a bit. In fact, Laura, I don't know if you've been to other countries or not overseas, but, you know, I still have what they call the traditional paper passport. Okay, it's that blue passport, you know, my U.S. Citizenship passport, and it's still blue. You know, all it has is just my picture and my passport, my unique identifier for my passport number. I still have not gotten what they call the e-passport, which is actually a biometric passport. And that's probably what these border officials are using. The passport holder probably has what they call a biometric passport. That biometric passport then probably contains a little chip, okay, that can contain both, I think. It can contain all three, the face, the iris, and the facial recognition templates all in one little chip. And then that passport then is flashed to the passport reader in order to confirm the identity of the traveler. And that's done through an RFID chip and through an RFID tag, which is a non-secure, you know, wireless network. And in fact, it could have been the case. Maybe it's not the individual, maybe it's not even a biometric. Maybe it's just the wireless communications that's taking place. That's not confirming the identity of the individual. Because it's not, with a biometric passport, what you have just told me, there's no direct contact with the traveler to the system or the passport to the system. Very likely he had a biometric passport and flashed that in front of the scanner. And if it's an RFID, I think it's what they call a radio frequency identification protocol, then it's a wireless, unencrypted communication. There could have been some issues with that too. So, again, his fingerprint could have been rejected for a whole plethora of reasons. Unless I read, you know, more about it, I really can't say any reasons. But, again, it could be his fingerprint, it could be a technology, it could even be the biometric passport himself. But if it's more than like maybe 15-20% of the population that's being rejected, it's probably something with the technology that's being, you know, that's not working right. Or the false accept or the false reject rate, those two metrics are not set up properly by the system administrator.
I'm actually quite surprised that U.S. citizens don't have the obligation to hold a biometrical passport, since everyone who wants to enter the U.S. is obliged to have a biometrical one. Since
well,
10 years, I guess.
Laura, here in the U.S., we are, I'll be honest, I mean, I'm not putting the United States down. I'm proud to have been born and brought up here. But as a society, we are so naive. I mean, we're such an ignorant society. It's out of my own laziness that I don't have a biometric passport. I'm just really, because I have no need to travel. I mean, really, all they do in the U.S. is they just check your Social Security card and your driver's license. I mean, seriously, that's all they do. I mean, I've not traveled abroad anywhere. The only traveling I did was to India back in 2001. So there's really no need for me to go through all the, you know, the nonsense and the, you know, bureaucracy to get another passport, because I don't mean to get political here, but with the current political climate, with the idiots we have in Washington, they've made the whole immigration system passport process such a nightmare now. I don't even want to go through that until, you know, changes are made, or until Trump's no longer president. Mm. But I'm not going to go on that. Trump is really, he's really made a mess of the whole immigration process and everything. It was messed up before, believe me, but it's even worse now. So that's why there's really no need to get a biometric passport for me right now. But, you know, one thing I will tell you, but at least with a driver's license, see, I live here in the state of Illinois, and they have actually made the driver's licenses contain, like, you know, facial recognition templates or fingerprint recognition templates. They're trying to upgrade their driver's licenses to become more like a miniature e-passport. Okay?
Wow.
And so these little cars, they do have, they can contain facial recognition and iris recognition templates. And all it is just basically a smart card. There's nothing more to it. There's nothing fancy as technology. It's like another, it's not as sophisticated as a biometric passport. It's just a smart card. Which can do the same thing, but on a more, like on a one-to-one verification, low-level, you know, sophistication needs for, you know, checking the identity of it. Of identity of an individual. Like, for example, if I get pulled over by a policeman, he's not going to ask to check my biometric passport. He's going to ask to check my driver's license. And that's just for those kinds of applications that it's used for. So it's not ultra sophisticated.
Good. I have one little comment before we move on to my next question, because facial recognition systems also boost in Europe after a terrorist attack in Berlin. It was in December 2016, I think, when individual struck into a crowd, and this person re-entered Europe with like 15 different identities, and they were like, well, if we would have had biometric, it was quite a story. And authorities discussed that this could have been prevented if biometrical systems like facial recognitions would have been applied already, because they had his face, or well, a picture of him in a database of, I don't know, like a mugshot. He already was convicted by some crimes in Europe.
Yeah, again, that comes down to the thing that we all have our unique face and our unique, you know, physiological features. So that's what they're coming at. You know, they're just trying to say another way, well, this guy has a unique face, so if we just use biometrics, then that's all that would have been needed, rather than having 15 different identities. That's all it comes down to.
Do you have in the States the discussion, like, personal data versus security, like that you have to make this trade-off? Is it huge? I guess
so. Laura,
I
can tell you all the stories of data privacy, data protection. That could be five different podcasts itself. That could be a whole entire book. Here in this country, as I said, we are such a naive and ignorant society. This now comes on the issue more of cybersecurity more so than biometrics, but, you know, the two overlap. The thing is, we, as you know, as Americans, we don't do anything to protect ourselves until we become a victim, okay? So, like, for example, the two best examples I can give are, like, the British Airways hack, you know, from their website, and then this thing that happened to the Marriott hotels here in the United States last year. I mean, that was probably, like, the biggest data breach that happened last year, is that I think millions of guests for this hotel resort chain, they had what they call their personal identifiable information, their PII, hijacked and stolen. It included their social security numbers, credit card information. They didn't know, I mean, the Hyatt hotels or Marriott hotels, they didn't know anything about it until 3 months later. And day, you know, every day, Laura, you know, I mean, I blog every weekend, and every day in the news headlines, there's always, every day, something of some data being breached, some passwords being sold in the dark web, you know, the Equifax being hacked into, some airline database being, every day here in the United States, there's something going on. It's crazy. It's too much. In fact, this morning, I was looking for a news headline on which to blog about, and 5 stories just straight directly were about databases being hacked into by a cyber attacker, probably from some foreign, you know, like North Korea, China, or whatever, you know, being hacked into. In fact, if you go to this one website called cywar.com, cywar.com, you'll see how many hacking stories occur here in the United States. Believe me. You'll see, I mean, just look at that for like, you know, 2 or 3 days in a row. My God, you're going to see like 5 headlines coming out every day on data hacking, data privacy, and so forth and so forth. In terms of data privacy legislation, there's really nothing here in the United States about data privacy legislation. I think Europe has much more than we do here. And I think the penalties are much more severe in Europe, you know, with the recent passage of the GDPR.
Is the birthday of the GDPR.
It's the 1-year anniversary. I was actually reading about that. That holds some legs. I mean, you can take someone to court, you know, or the government can take someone to court and actually, you know, sue them. You know, and the penalties are pretty severe. It can be like, I think, hundreds of millions of dollars or 4% of your net profit. I mean, it's pretty serious.
Google
but
Spain,
here in this,
it's amazing. Yeah. Google
yeah,
Spain
here,
has
here
to pay
country,
50 million euros to me.
Here in this country, Laura, I mean, we don't have anything here. I mean, we have things like Sarbanes-Oxley, I think Graham, Lilly, Beach, but those are more for accounting controls, okay, more for like money laundering things, okay? In terms of strict data privacy, data security, there's really nothing out here. The only thing that I know that's come into being is that California passed this bill for the Internet of Things, you know, try to protect our data, you know, with the IoT evolving. But even then, that was such a joke. It was the general blanket law that was passed. There are no specifics about anything. So it's just because the U.S. is such a big country, Laura. There's so many cultures, so many, you know, ethnicities, this, that, you know, it's hard to implement anything. You know, I mean, the states can pass things. And if anything's passed, Laura, I mean, our court systems are so slow. I mean, you would think, like in India, where the court systems are so slow, there we're even slower than India. I mean, seriously. I mean, the time it takes to get anything to trial, to legislation, I mean, it can take years. And at that point, it's just better to settle the data privacy case out of court than to, you know, waste money, you know, with lawyers and the judges. I mean, seriously, that's what it comes down to. As Americans, we are probably one of the worst in the world, you know, in terms of what they call cyber hygiene. You know, in terms of maintaining good levels of security. Seriously. I mean, we're horrible. So, I don't know what the
regarding
question is. No, go ahead.
But regarding cybersecurity, I mean, Brad Smith just proposed, I think 2 years ago, the idea of a digital Geneva Convention to at least provide some security of, in the cyberspace. Do you think it's realistic, because this will like concern more big companies?
Well, no, I think this legislation is going to impact more of, it's going to impact U.S. companies that do business in those countries where this law has been established, but it's not going to impact U.S. citizens directly, no. So if suppose my credit card got stolen here, it's not going to have any impact on me. But companies that do business like in Europe or the EC, yeah, they're going to be bound by those GDPR laws or Geneva Convention laws. So.
Okay. Do you think it's realistic that we will hold at someday a smart card which holds our biometrical data and that it's encrypted?
Oh, we are. We actually already are, Laura. I mean,
really?
In the United States, now that comes down to a whole new different social implication issue of whether. Now, here's how it's looked at. Okay, yes, like employees of companies here in the U.S., we do have smart cards, okay? If you work for a big Fortune 500 company, yes, you have to have a smart card, and yes, you have to have a biometric template in order to gain access to the building, okay? But that does not mean that smart card can be used to access everything that you have here in the United States, okay?
Yeah.
That comes down to the question of a national ID card. That is something that you probably will not see here in the United States because that's too much of a controversial privacy rights issue kind of thing. There's been talk about that, but nobody really wants that. People think it's just too much of a violation of privacy rights and civil liberties. In fact, I think I was going to write about that in my second book about the national ID card, and I think there might even be a chapter on that. I don't remember. No, there will never really be a thing called a national ID card. Now, it might be in Europe. But, yeah, I mean, on a local level, yes, we do have, you know, smart cards, you know, like, you know, when we travel or, you know, when we, you know, have to confirm our identity to our employer, you know, for it as a means of physical access entry. But in terms of an absolute national level, no, we probably will not see a national ID card like maybe Europe has right now. Now, I don't know if Europe has that or not, but, yeah, it won't happen.
Not yet, no. Okay.
Yeah, because I think Europe will probably have it first, then the U.S. will probably be the last, if it ever does have it. You'll probably see the developing countries of Asia and Africa have that more so than, I think, Europe and the U.S.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Well, I also would like to talk to you about gender bias and racial bias in facial recognition systems.
Okay.
Because Amazon has this facial recognition system called Recognition. And then the ACLU made a test with, they tried to match Congress members with mugshots. And apparently 28 members of Congress have been wrongly identified, especially dark-skinned people. So 28 people from the Congress have been identified with a mugshot picture.
Yeah, excuse my ignorance on that one. I didn't really hear about that story either. As I said, I've been kind of out of the biometrics loop for a little while now. I've been in cybersecurity. I did not hear about that story. But I did hear about the Amazon facial recognition system. Based from my years of experience in biometrics, these systems are meant to confirm or verify the identity of any individual of any race, okay? Now, the only question where it may come down to is if, suppose, one race has a different fingerprint shape than another race, okay? Well, for example, maybe the Chinese have a smaller fingerprint than American than Caucasians do. Maybe the eyes have a little bit of a different structure. You know, I don't know. It could just all come down the way that we were born into these cultures and was transcended down to us in our DNA from our parents. But no, I mean, facial recognition, I mean, biometric technologies absolutely, in absolute sense, are not designed for, like, racial profiling. Probably what happened was, if it was a facial recognition system, either the technology just wasn't quite up to par, it wasn't tested, or they used it on different lighting environments. That could have been the case too. Or it just could have been the case where it may not have been able to pick up the differences in the skin color. But yeah, I mean, here in America, Laura, believe me, anything that, you know, if you see an African American or a foreigner, you know, being exposed to a biometric system and they're rejected, that's always the cause for, you know, racial profiling. Or even, you know, and it's sad, yeah, it's sad to say too, even you know, Middle Easterners, innocent Middle Easterners who have nothing to do with, you know, anything. You know, I mean, some of the people I know here in my apartment building, these Middle Easterners are, they're some of the finest people, you know, I've ever come across in my entire life. You know, they are law abiding, but anytime they are rejected by a system, like even any security system, they can always, you know, they, there's always the claim of racial profiling. It's just the way that our society has become, especially with the current administration. I mean, suppose a Middle Easterner gets pulled over for a traffic ticket. They'll claim it's racial profiling. And it very well could be, because here in this country, I mean, there's so much of white, there's so much of prejudice now because of Trump. You know, again, I'm not trying to get political, but that's just the climate that we live in here in this country right now. You know, there's these neo-Nazi gangs, there are these white supremacist groups, you know, and everything, which, you know, Laura, you know, with Obama, nobody even heard of these things. I mean, they were there, but, you know, with Reagan, Bush, younger, you know, Obama, these cases weren't there. But with what we have now with Trump, I mean, it's just, it's crazy. You know, they're, you know, Ku Klux Klan's coming out, you know, they're, you know, they're saying that, you know, African Americans should be targeted, blah, blah, blah. So anytime a different race is rejected, whether it's Middle East, Asian, or what have you, you know, African American, there will always will be claims of racial profiling. And it's not the fault of the technology. It could be that something just didn't go right. It wasn't set up properly. But in this country, we will always find excuses for racial profiling. Whenever we can, believe it. You have no idea. I don't know if you've been to the United States before or not, but believe me, it's always like that here. You know, I mean, an African American person gets pulled over by a car here in Chicago, it makes the headlines. Oh, racial profiling. So, now, if I get pulled over by a cop, although I'm of Indian descent, I'm Asian looking, nobody will care, right? So that's the way it is in our country. So. Yeah, the racial profiling, I mean, why those centers weren't recognized, I don't know. I mean, it could have been a technical glitch on the system. In an absolute sense, there's no racial profiling by the biometric system. I mean, the vendors don't create it, do it that way. I mean, if they do it that way, then these vendors are going to get sued. You know, and here in the United States, Florida, we live in a sue-happy society. Okay? And we can sue, someone will sue someone. And that's just the way it is. But, yeah, they're not meant to do that. And it's just probably something that just didn't go right or the environment wasn't set up properly. And because of that, they're claiming, you know, racial profiling.
A researcher in the MIT, I think her name was Choi Bualavaini, she also made a very similar study with facial recognition systems from IBM, Face Plus and Microsoft, maybe. And apparently, these programs had not all the same issues, but they also had problems to identify dark-skinned people, especially dark-skinned women. And then she apparently found out that the algorithm was trained with the same data set, and the data set did not represent dark-skinned women very well. So it was not good trained, the algorithm, and therefore it had more difficulties to identify women.
Right.
And could that be possible? I mean, I have no idea of technology, but if this is true...
It could be possible because, as I've said, you know, and that reminds me of another topic, because now these days, facial recognition systems are becoming very, they're using a lot of, you know, sophisticated technologies in facial recognition systems. So here in this country, in the cybersecurity world, the big buzzwords now are artificial intelligence and machine learning. Okay. So it's quite possible now that these facial recognition systems are using, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning to learn and to project what future profiles could look like. So, for example, if a facial recognition system it has an AI package or a machine learning tool in it, and it takes a picture of Laura and Tommy, and it creates your profile, your template, it's going to try to learn from that and try to create future templates based on that and try to project what a future template could look like. In other words, it's trying to use predictive analytics to predict what future people could look like down the road, okay? And unfortunately, these algorithms probably are not learned well enough. So, for example, I don't know if I'm explaining this well enough, but I know in artificial intelligence and machine learning, you have to have enough data fed into them so that they can learn properly over a period of time and they can make good decisions. So like, for example, in cybersecurity, like in threat hunting or penetration testing, there are a lot of, like, you know, I'm tongue-tied here, repetition, a lot of tasks that get repeated over and over again, okay? So these teams, what they try to do is they try to use AI and ML to automate these repetitious tasks, right? So that the humans don't have to do it. But the AI and the ML tools, they have to have enough data sets and they have to be trained well enough in order to do these task automations very well so they don't make any errors. And that's probably what's happening with these facial recognition systems. They're not being fed enough unique data from different cultures, different genders, enough to learn how to predict and model, you know, women of different, you know, cultures and different, you know, ethnicities and different, you know, color. They need to be fed a whole wide variety of data sets, you know, probably like enough for like a data warehousing application or a big data application. I mean, you simply can't just plug in 5 people, you know, into the facial recognition system and expect that to learn and project an accurate picture of what an individual could look like. You know, it's got to have millions and millions of pictures in order for it to really come up with something that's even halfway, you know, that can predict at a reasonable level. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, when I think about my topic, my master thesis topic, and I think about dark-skinned women trying to seek asylum in Europe, and because the algorithm isn't well-trained and the data set wasn't diverse enough and did not include, like, their looks, that might be, like, very... the possible impact on their life is massive because it can be that their application is denied and they're sent back into country of war. So it seems very important to have minimal standards, how an algorithm should be trained, how the data set should look like. But at the moment, I think there are no regulations at all. No. Or is there something?
In fact, Laura, you bring up a very, very important point, because in the biometrics industry, now, in this country, there are a lot of, like, government committees, a lot of government groups, okay? You know, there's, like, you know, NIST, there's the BioAPI, there are a lot of different consortiums that they have their own set of standards. But there is, as far as I know, and I'm not saying that there isn't, but as far as I know, there is no set of international best standards and best practices and guidelines of how a biometric system should be set up and established to recognize people of all different walks of life from all over the world so that there's a low rate of rejection. No, you're absolutely right. There needs to be a set of these best standards and best practices, which, as far as I know, doesn't exist. It has to be on an international level.
Yeah. Well, I guess especially on a global level, because, like, we move all the time, more than ever before, so I think. Do you think this will be implemented sometime soon?
The
best standards? Exactly.
This is gonna take forever. Believe me, if they haven't come with anything yet, I mean, biometrics has been around since, like, the 1940s, 1950s, and it's already halfway through 2020. It's probably going to take another 20 years because, you know, all the countries have to come into agreement. And, you know, there might be countries around the world like Africa and Asia who can probably come to a quicker consensus because they see the need for it much more than maybe Europe or America. But, yeah, now when you bring in Europe and America, now Europe will probably be quicker but slower than these, you know, developing countries because there still be some issues of privacy rights. But remember, you got to bring the U.S. on board also. And with us on board, believe me, we will slow the whole thing down. So it'll be years and years and probably decades till this thing evolves and comes into fruition because every country has to agree to it. It just can't be, you know, like the European Union or the European community and the United States. It's got to be every country in order to have equitable process for biometric, you know, verification or identification. That's just my view, but no. You ask a politician, they'll probably say something different. I'm just saying more from the, you know, from the my view as a biometrics and cybersecurity professional, you know, from my tech background, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's also huge lobbying because it's a multi-billion industry.
Oh, yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, in this country,
wow.
Believe me. Or, I mean, the lobbying, you know. It's the government bureaucracy is just unreal here now. I mean, seriously, and the time it takes to pass anything now. Unfortunately, this all comes down to politics. I mean, anything that comes to cybersecurity protection, you know, having like national mandates or, you know, like biometric mandates on a national level, it just comes down to politics. And unfortunately, you know, we have to have the House pass the bill, the Senate has to pass the bill, and this idiot we have in you know, as a president, he has to sign, right? So all three have to agree, and for that to make it and become a reality, Laura, that's good. That's really laughable. It's never gonna happen. You know, the gridlock that we have here in this country. I mean, we can't even get a national legislation passed on best standards for cybersecurity. Yeah, I mean, it's just unfortunate. It's the political climate, and it all has to come down to our government. It has to enforce all this stuff. We can't do it as citizens or, you know, or as private companies. Now, a company can adopt their own set of best practices, okay? So, like, for example, like Microsoft, I mean, for their own employees, they can implement a set of best practices, you know, like how to create a password and how to maintain your password. But as a society mandate, no. I mean, it may never even happen. So.
Then I have one last question. It's about
I think I have 15 more minutes scheduled for the show. But yeah, ask as many as you want. You can go up until last minute if you like.
Perfect. Thank you so much. It's about cybersecurity. You explained something that in the end, when a template gets hacked, nothing happens because it's just like a mathematical formula. But still, I mean, there's so many data, especially like personal and very sensitive data stored, like in private companies, but also stored by the government. What has to be done to make it as secure as possible, especially since there is much more nation-state attacks going on than maybe 10, 15 years ago?
Okay.
The
government can do a lot of things, but unfortunately, as I said, we live in such a reactive society. I mean, it's unfortunate, but on a theoretical level, there are two things that the government and even private businesses need to do. One is they just need to secure their own internal IT infrastructure, okay? They need to implement the proper levels of security so that it can't be easily hacked into. Now, this begs the question, can anything be hacked into? Yes, even the most fortified business, even, you know, Fort Knox in Louisville, Kentucky, you know, where all that gold is stored, even that could. Maybe not on a physical level, just because there's so many armed guards there, but on a IT level, that thing could probably be hacked into if the cybersecurity attacker is smart enough. There's no such thing as a 100% secure premises. There's always gaps in something. all a company or a government can do is implement the best safeguards that they can to protect it to the level that they can. I mean, this all comes down to making sure that your infrastructure is protected from the inside and the outside, you know, with firewalls, network intrusion devices, you know, AI tools. On a constant basis, you have to make sure that any holes or any vulnerabilities that are present in your IT infrastructure are always checked for. And again, that's where penetration and threat hunting comes down to. With pen testing, you're breaking down the walls of defense to see where the holes are. With threat hunting, you're examining how weak your internal IT infrastructure is. That needs to be, you know, do these kinds of tests on a regular basis, like once a quarter, to see where the weaknesses are and get them filled quickly. So that's one thing. On a very macro level, these companies and governments, they need to protect their databases, and it all comes down to cryptography. Now, cryptography is a very complex field. It's very highly mathematical. And what that involves is basically, Laura, making data into a garbled state of format. So if somebody were to intercept the data, they wouldn't know what to do with it unless they had the right key to go with it. So, for example, suppose you want to send me a private email about a question you have on biometrics, and you don't want to have anybody see that. Well, you would encrypt that email message. You'd make it into a garbled state so that if it were to be intercepted, nobody could read it. Once it comes to me, then I can decrypt it with my appropriate key to read what you said. Okay? So it all comes down to cryptography, you know, using cryptographic principles, you know, using public key infrastructures, you know, using, you know, all these fancy mathematical algorithms to keep the data in garbled and, you know, stateless format so that even if anybody were to hack into it, there's really not much that they can do with it. Then the second thing that they need to do is that they need to then worry about then, okay, now that I have all my IT infrastructure protected, now I need to protect the people that are connecting to my IT infrastructure from the outside world. So, for example, suppose Microsoft now has implemented all these crazy levels of security to protect their IT infrastructures. Well, now they have to protect the remote connectivity for their employees who remotely log in from home into their IT infrastructure. That connection has to be made secure, too, because if a cyber attacker wanted to, you could easily intercept that line of communication and write on that and then break into the IT infrastructure, okay? And that is a huge hot topic in this country because a lot of attention has not been paid to it. So this is where the role of a virtual private network or a VPN would come into play. Have you heard of VPNs before, virtual private networks?
Yes.
Okay. That's where the role of essentially what a VPN is, it establishes two layers of communication. One, it shows your connection available to the outside world. Then just beneath that, then it establishes your own secure private connection from your laptop to the data that you're trying to connect to the database. So it's kind of like giving cyber attacker another avenue to poke at without knowing that you really are connected into another way. So the use of VPNs is going to be very important. And in fact, I think that first book I wrote, Laura, I think you have access to, I write a lot about how biometrics can be used in biocryptography and how biometrics can be used in the cloud and how VPNs can make use of biometrics also. There's a lot of, I think, content, I think, towards chapter 4 and 5 on that that you may want to take a look at too.
I will, definitely. So why isn't it installed at the moment? Or is it? When I read like the papers and I did some research, it seemed like there are possibilities to protect data better, but they're not yet applied. Why is that so? Well, okay. Politics.
Here in the United States, we have the technology. I mean, Europe, the technology is there. I think Europeans do a far better job of it because they have that GDPR now. But in the United States, we're lazy. I mean, we have the technology. We can do it. But we're just lazy. We're just a reactive society. I mean, I think 9/11 probably could have very well been prevented. But unfortunately, you know, the Bush administration just didn't, you know, react to the intelligence feed that they're getting from the CIA and the FBI. they didn't act on that. In fact, these 11 terrorists or 12, you know, 13 terrorists or who, you know, whatever the number was, they took flying lessons at private schools, and even the flight instructors, they said that they demonstrated very erratic behavior. Now, if they had erratic behavior, then why didn't they report that to the authorities, right? Why weren't they investigated? Why wasn't their passports checked? We just live in, we just take things for granted. We live in a very reactive society. We don't do anything until we're hit first. That's just the way it is here. I mean, I'm sorry to say that, but I mean, we're a very technologically advanced country. I mean, we have over 2,000, you know, cybersecurity companies in this country, you know, with offices all over the world, but we still can't protect ourselves because we just don't want to do anything until we're hit. And that's what it all comes down to.
Is there also something positive going on, or do we end the podcast quite pessimistic?
Well, unfortunately, Laura, that's just the way the cybersecurity world is. I mean, there are a lot of people like us who want to make an impact on the world and on society, but it's just the way, I mean, it's just a very pessimistic thing. I mean, the amount of data breaches that happen and the amount of, I mean, it's crazy. Just, as I said, just do a Google search and you must still see every day something's happening. It's just unfortunate. But the good thing is, to end on a positive note, that there are companies out there that want to do the right thing, that they want to help people. But people just don't want to listen to them. They think the mentality is, oh, well, it hasn't happened to me. It never will happen, you know? And unfortunately, that's not the right thing. Right? And that's just the mentality of Americans. You know, it goes to the old saying, you know, if it isn't broken, why fix it, right? So that can be equated to a cybersecurity. If I'm not a victim yet, then I probably won't be a victim. But, you know, and then if you become a victim, only then will you take the proactive steps. But, yeah. I mean, Laura, we have all of the innovation. We have all the brilliant people here. I'm sure Europe has the same or more. We have all the technologies, artificial intelligence, machine learning. We have brilliant scientists, engineers. But it's just the society that we live in. Unfortunately, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest – oh, go ahead.
I feel like Europe had a very emergency-driven approach to deal with issues.
They do.
But I feel like we're moving towards a risk management approach, especially since 2015 when we had this migration waves and we had very bad procrastinations on the numbers and we were not prepared to be able to have a productive border management. And since then, since we had this overwhelmment and this situation, we try to, like, on different levels, to have a better risk management approach. But it still takes time to get there.
Yeah, it does. And that's why I say that Europe is probably far much more advanced in terms of people taking proactive. I mean, we all have it. I mean, Europe probably has the same levels of technology the United States does, maybe better in terms of sophistication, but the mentality is much different in Europe. I think people are much more proactive. You know, they take much more interest in security than we do in the United States. Because I know England, I mean, I think it was back in maybe last decade, there was that one train attack. I mean, within days, the UK, the police force, they looked at the, you know, CCTV camera and facial recognition systems, and they had the people caught like within 3 days. I think they're trying to leave the country, but they caught them right before. And to me, that just shows how proactive, you know, Europe is, you know, with their measures. So that's just the way the United States is right now. Unfortunately, I wish I could say something better, but from all the years I've been doing, that's just what it all kind of comes down to.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, those have been all my questions. Thank you so much for answering them. It was very clear and interesting. Thank you a lot.
No problem. If you ever want to do our podcast about this, let me know, okay? And if you just want to have a top conversation just on the social aspects of biometric technology, I'd be more than happy to do that. And we'll be in touch, Laura, okay? Take care.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Bye.